Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Novelist William Gibson has spent his long and distinguished writing career exploring ideas about space, in particular, how the future will deal with physical space, emotional space, cyberspace.
In fact, we have Gibson to thank for crafting the modern definition of the word cyberspace back in the 1980s. Those were the early days of the digital revolution when the outlines of the modern internet and all its incarnations were the stuff of science fiction.
Gibson is still thinking about a future space and a cyber future, and he is with us here now in Radio Boston's studio to talk about the future and also about his new book called The Peripheral. William Gibson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, I know you were listening to the segment we just did as you waited to come in, and it occurred to me that you probably would be a really ideal person to riff a little bit on what it means that we are now seeing students having tablets in the classroom. I mean, it is a piece of the future that has finally arrived in a very physical space. Does that occur to you, or am I making a stretch here?
No. I was listening, and I kept coming back to the idea that none of the people who conceived, developed, or marketed the tablets we're talking about could possibly have envisioned the questions that segment was asking. We don't. Change is increasingly driven by emergent technology, and yet we don't legislate technology into emergence. It appears, and then we try to figure out what people are actually going to do with it and what it's going to do with people.
I really enjoy going into movies and plays and books, knowing almost nothing about what I'm about to see or hear or read. So I really don't want to give too much away about your novel for people who want to have it totally unfold with surprise. But would you talk generally a bit about how, when you write, how you're deciding how much of the past, the present, and the future to combine? I know, for example, many of the reviews about your book so far keep referencing that the cronut makes an appearance.
Yes.
People find that a real novelty. How are you deciding what to blend from the different parts of time?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure that I'm generally, when I'm working, that conscious of how I'm making. I'm constantly making those little calls. One thing I keep in mind, though, is that there is no element of the real future in my imagining of the future. All I have is the historical past and the present moment. And from those, I somehow manage to combine things which I can present to the reader as being the future. And I'm constantly trying to finesse that so that the reader will buy it.
You've been writing about the future for decades, and I'm wondering what it feels like to now be in the future, or in the present, which when you were writing about it was the future. And in some cases, some of the things that you may have imagined up or thought might be now might be. So when you see Google Glass and when you see self-driving cars or a waiting list for tourist trips to the moon, is it ever odd to think, wow, some of these things actually happened?
Well, it is odd, but life in the 21st century, or for that matter, the 20th, I've always found rather odd generally. And I had written 6 novels set in imaginary futures in the 20th century. And at the start of the 21st, I began to write 3 set in the early 21st century. Each one was actually set in the year before it would be published. And I did that because I felt I'd lost track of the bandwidth of weirdness in the given day in the world outside the window.
Well, by the way, what do you find sort of weird? What is the weirdness about life today?
Well, that segment on tablets and teachers and students' parents discussing the possible 30-year effects on brain biology with these gizmos that their children are buying at Target or wherever. I find that inherently strange, but it's not at all what I would have made up in the 20th century to be a concern of the early 21st. It's odd because it's the way reality actually plays out. And I sometimes feel I watch it play out before me every day.
Well, and it must be very interesting for you in particular as someone who has spent so much of your writing life trying to imagine or maybe project what's to come, and you get the opportunity to see whether some of what you imagined or projected ever materializes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I feel very privileged to be around to see it.
In your debut novel, Neuromancer, you wrote a bit about sort of a place in which we're all immersed with our devices, right? And there's a divide between the people who have them and the people who don't. And that's
yes.
a big conversation today,
yes.
the digital divide.
Yes.
Have things played out how you anticipated?
Well, I suspected when I wrote Neuromancer that the devices would be far more ubiquitous and used for far more mundane and interesting things than I would be able to present in the book.
More interesting things?
Yeah, well, no, more that there would be more...
Oh, more sort of the basics.
Yeah, the basics. Recipes, romance, all the things we actually do on the internet today. I suspected that would be the bulk of it, as, you know, it is. But for the sake of the sort of story I was telling, I couldn't concentrate on that. It had to be the equivalent of bank robberies, and it had to involve conspiracy theories. It had to be very dark and dramatic. But another part of me thought, well, if I were writing a naturalistic novel about the future, it would be recipes and romances and travel advice.
And you feel like the way we use our devices now are for more interesting reasons or with a lot more variety than you had foreseen?
Well, what I didn't foresee, I think, the main thing that I didn't foresee is that over the past 30 years, cyberspace, so-called, has completely colonized the real world, so-called, and the distinction is largely gone.
That it's all one and the same.
Yeah,
it's taken over so much.
It's all one and the same. I coined the word cyberspace to represent another realm, and it was a weird place, and things happened differently, and that's no longer the case. And cyberspace, I think, is now something of a legacy term, but the real world is now something of a legacy term.
I know you have said before that you think many of us automatically think of the people that came before us as kind of rubes,
yes.
like pre-technology hicks. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to decide if I had that same feeling. Do I give people today credit for being more sophisticated in some way? But do you think that's the case, because with technology comes sophistication?
I think that we flatter ourselves in believing that with technology comes sophistication. I think that part of the reason that Deadwood was so popular and so deeply enjoyed is that we were finally shown just how diabolically clever these hicks in the past could be.
One of the when people write about the future, and particularly when it's kind of a dystopian view of the future, it's like a fallen world, a world that's collapsed. And that makes me wonder whether, when you look at the present today, I mean, you've talked about how you think the devices are used a bit more interestingly than you expected and so forth. Do you feel optimistic about the future? Do you view it in terms of optimism or pessimism?
I actually, professionally, I try to be agnostic about it. I have my Luddite moments and my moments of rampant technophilia. But when I'm really doing my job properly, I'm viewing it as an anthropologist, or something akin to an anthropologist. I actually avoid keeping my own devices thoroughly up to date, because I think that it helps me to watch other people using technology that I haven't yet used.
How? How does it help you?
Well, because I can observe them using it. Once I'm using it, I'm no longer conscious of the same peculiarities of how behavior changes. As it's one of the most puzzling things about technology is that once we have it, I think we become it. And imagining the world or even ourselves prior to having it becomes very, very difficult.
You're making me think of when iPhones first came out, everybody who got one was just immersed in it. No matter where they were buried in it, and they wanted to show everybody else what it could do, which could be irritating to other people until they got their own iPhones and they did the exact same thing.
Well, it was only evident to you that they were, you know, feverishly immersed in it, because at that point you were still living in a world that involved relative solitude, which has now disappeared.
We only have about a minute left, but I'm now realizing I want to know what kind of technology is in William Gibson's life. What kind of devices do you use?
I have a tablet, and I have a rather out-of-date iPhone and a Mac Air, and that's really about it.
Well, that's really interesting to hear. We are so glad you were able to come to the studio. And for listeners who would like to meet you, and I imagine hear you read from your new book, you'll be appearing tonight at 7 o'clock at First Parish Church in Harvard Square. This is sci-fi writer William Gibson we've been talking to. His new book is The Peripheral. Many other books you've written, including some referred to the trilogy. There's the Sprawl trilogy, which Neuromancer is in. There's the Bridge trilogy, which is Virtual Light. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been really fun to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate you coming in.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.